morning. That's very chipper, since we're in this room way far away from everybody else. Okay, before I start talking about PID surveillance, let's talk a little bit about what PID is. PID, or pelvic inflammatory disease, is an infection of the uterus, fallopian tubes, or other female reproductive organs, which results in inflammation. PID has numerous infectious etiologies, many of which have been demonstrated to be sexually transmitted. Infection ascends from the cervix, and PID can either be symptomatic or asymptomatic. PID is important to monitor, as we're going to talk about today. It may lead to tubal factor infertility, and PID is also associated with ectopic pregnancy, chronic pelvic pain. In the U.S., PID is estimated to occur in approximately 1 million women annually, and it's the most immediate adverse outcome of chlamydial and gonococcal infections. So surveillance is a component of program evaluation used to assess the impact of chlamydia and gonorrhea prevention and control efforts. We face numerous challenges in PID surveillance, many of which will be illustrated here this morning. First, the PID diagnosis is based on clinical signs and symptoms, and there's no corresponding laboratory definition. The diagnosis is insensitive and lacks specificity. The gold standard of laparoscopy is not widely available or widely used for numerous reasons. And the whole PID that we're focusing on today actually will miss asymptomatic tubal infections. When we try to extract PID cases from our data, we've used ICD-9 codes to pull them out for analysis and surveillance purposes. The most common, 614.9, which is just generally female pelvic inflammatory disease, not otherwise specified, has a really low positive predictive value of only 18.1% when comparing it to the CDC PID case definition, which I'll talk about in a minute. If you pair that with a positive chlamydia test, the positive predictive value does increase to 56%. In addition, there have been changes in case management over time, with a movement towards outpatient management of PID. So let's talk briefly about definitions, because I know Gail is going to go into this a little bit further. There are two different definitions. There's a surveillance definition, and there's a clinical definition that really is for empiric treatment of PID. The surveillance definition requires all three criteria to be met of lower abdominal tenderness, cervical motion tenderness, and adnexal tenderness, whereas the definition for empiric treatment requires only one of these three. And in addition, you'll see that the surveillance definition also requires one of these other criteria, long list of which is shown. So, talking briefly about PID case reporting, PID is not a nationally notifiable condition. However, it is reportable in 20 states, in the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, as of 2009. And for example, in California, which again we're going to hear more about California case reporting, a report is required within 7 days of diagnosis. The local health jurisdiction reports to the Department of Health. And in 2005, there were 7.1 cases per 100,000 women reported, for a total of just over 1,300 cases. If you'll remember the estimated 1 million cases that occur, you'll see that this is a gross underestimate. When we look at national data sources for PID surveillance, those that are available annually, there's two primary sources. The National Hospital Discharge Survey, or NHDS, consists of patients hospitalized for PID, data on patients hospitalized for PID, and it's a national sample survey of medical records of patients discharged from acute care hospitals in the U.S. We also use the National Disease and Therapeutic Index, which consists on data from initial visits of patients to private physicians' offices where they've come for PID. And it's a probability sample survey. When we look at data from the National Hospital Discharge Survey, we see a relative decline over time. However, you can see some fluctuation. And so the x-axis is years, and the y-axis is hospitalizations in thousands. And we have two lines. Yellow is acute unspecified PID, which is of more interest in this symposium that we're covering today. When we look at data from the National Disease and Therapeutic Index, we also see a similar decline in visits per thousand from about 250,000 visits to around 120,000 visits in 2008. There was also a paper that was published in 2005 doing an analysis of three annual national probability surveys: the National Hospital Discharge Survey, the National Hospital Ambulatory Medical Care Survey, the National Ambulatory Medical Care Survey. This is totally tongue twister. And for comparison, Sutton et al. Used the National Disease and Therapeutic Index. And again, as I mentioned before, they use ICD-9 codes to extract possible PID cases from these databases. And what she found was, again, as we've seen in our other data sources, a gradual decrease over time. You can see here in this figure that these bars are stacked according to age groups, and there was an overall decrease of 68% and a 77% decrease among women aged 20 to 24 year olds. And this was the greatest decrease of all age groups. We also saw a 53% decrease among 15 to 19 year olds. Here we see rates of PID in ambulatory settings from the same paper. And overall, according to these data, we saw a 47% decrease. These data sources do have several limitations. They're all surveys, and surveys have limited precision, small sample sizes and large sampling errors. And this is particularly important as rates decrease. These are estimates and not actual counts, and we don't have any accompanying data on chlamydial or gonococcal infections, limiting our ability to assess program impact. So we're trying to think about alternate data sources that may be used for PID, and Bohm et al., in a paper that was just published in STD in March, unfortunately you have the February issue in your packet, but go check out the March issue. She looked at PID among privately insured women using administrative claims data, covering the time frame from 2001 to 2005. Again, ICD-9 codes were used to identify possible PID cases. And the larger question around this is whether or not this might be a valuable new data source for PID surveillance. It's a large, convenient sample. We do get actually data on privately insured individuals, and there are additional data elements available in this data source that may not be available in other data sources. So what she found, just briefly, she again, it's a broken record, found an overall decrease of 25.5%, and the largest decrease was 33.3% in the 15 to 19-year-olds. Again, the largest decrease was in a younger age group, and you can see that highlighted in the red line on this figure. When she looked at rates by region, there was a 29.8% decrease in the South, which is the top line, and an 11% decrease in the West. And while it doesn't look that impressive, it also was significant. All right, so moving beyond ICD-9 codes, we are also collaborating to develop a new PID case-finding algorithm with our partners at Group Health in Washington and Seattle. What we're looking at to see if the presence of, if other variables can impact the performance of the algorithm in doing a better job to extract PID cases from administrative data. And what we found is that presence of appropriate treatment is key. Age is also an important predictor in the algorithm. The algorithm sensitivity was high, 95 to 98%. However, specificity was still low at only 45 to 50%. And when you look at the misclassification rate of the algorithm at 14 to 16% and compare that to the misclassification rate based on solely on ICD-9 codes, which has again been sort of the standard of practice that we've been using, you'll see that there actually is some improvement. Is it great? No. Is it better? Yes. And unfortunately, at the very same time as this session, Delia Scholes is presenting on this algorithm. I do encourage you to go read the abstract or watch the presentation online. It's abstract C5D, and you can hear all about it. So overall, is what I've shown you convincing evidence of an impact? What I've shown you is PID seems to be decreasing. Well, we also know that chlamydia screening is increasing. How is that associated with decreasing PID? And how much PID is due to chlamydia and gonorrhea? Where there was a symposium yesterday talking about chlamydia immunology, and a lot of questions remain. We know that PID is non-specific and non-standardized. The data are subject to many limitations. As I've talked about, the next steps are to try to figure out new data sources, including expanded use of administrative data, and particular importance in looking at program impact to assess the proportion of PID with chlamydia or gonorrhea. That's it. So everybody else is going to tell you a lot more. Does anybody have any initial questions? Yes.
Is it true that morbidity and mortality from PID more than HIV women? Is it true?
Oh, good question. Oh, okay. The question was, is it true that morbidity and mortality from PID is greater than morbidity and mortality associated with HIV in women? I do not know. I don't know the statistics for HIV. I'm sorry. Morbidity of PID, obviously, can lead to ectopic pregnancy and tubal factor infertility. Tubal factor infertility can be especially costly and damaging. Mortality from PID is probably fairly limited, so I would guess that it may not, I don't, it, maybe it's comparing two different things too. So I'm sorry, I'm not able to answer that any better.
I read it somewhere that morbidity and mortality of PID much more than HIV and AIDS.
Okay. I'll have to look into that. Thank you for asking the question. Anybody else? Yes.
So the one here you're showing is data that seems at least very suggestive of a lot of impact. But in terms of the numbers and the various indices that you're looking at, going back to the original numbers that we started with, we have this very large estimated number. We have very poor reporting. So the numbers that you're looking at in the indices, how does that, what does that tell us about the number that we started with for the
decline? So you're talking about the 1 million that I cited early on?
Like,
right.
Is that validated by...
It's an older estimate, I would say. And the tricky thing, I have to repeat the question for the recording. Are the data that I show a validation of the initial estimate of the 1 million? How does the data I showed reflect that?
Or what is the, what would you extract from your data, the
burden?
Yeah.
Okay, so what would I extrapolate from my data to be the true burden of PID? And that's a tough question because I think one of the most critical things about PID, in my opinion, is this whole asymptomatic PID. Because I think there's evidence to show that infection can be asymptomatic and it can still cause damage. So I don't think there's probably actually a way to wrap your hands around PID in totality in terms of symptomatic PID that's coming in, people coming into provider's office. That the million that I gave you is actually the middle of a broad range of estimates. Sutton estimated about 840,000, and I think that was based upon the range of the data that she presented. So I think it's probably maybe a little bit lower than a million now, but I think our data are still so limited that it's difficult to give a concrete number.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe other people are going to get at this, but how do you think testing people without doing pelvics is influencing the surveillance data?
Okay. Okay, so how do I think that decreased testing of people during pelvic exams is impacting?
The proportion of people being tested who get a pelvic is probably declining.
Right.
They have options.
Right.
Okay. Won't that drop the number of PID cases?
I think that's interesting. I think there's anecdotal evidence to certainly show that even diagnosed PID is milder than it has been in the past. So I think that there's probably, my impression would be that there's less recognition of symptoms even among the individual patients. So they might not even feel themselves to need an exam, and that they might not be prompted to recognize signs and symptoms unless they had that exam. So I think you're right. I think our detection abilities are going to be hindered because of that, given that disease may be milder. Yes.
So the CDC case definition was written in 1991 or something like that, and it's very strict as you showed, and it's the treatment guidelines are based on a much.
Howie, that's my talk.
Gail Bolin will be following up on this. Gail would love to answer it. Okay, any clarifying questions or we can move on? I think there's going to be a little bit of time at the end, too. Thank you.
Thanks.